faith in Hebrews chapter 11 as being a persistent or a perseverant faith. And then we've noted how that you can break the chapter and on into the next chapter into three major parts where he looks at the patriarchs, he looks at Moses and those who are in the Mosaic age, so-called, and then we are going to come into the Christian age, if you will, tomorrow. As we talked about that patriarchal faith yesterday, we're going to talk about the faith during the, as evidenced in the time of Moses, as a persecuted faith. Now, we've already kind of gotten hints of that when we looked at Abel, who made the ultimate sacrifice, if you will, though the focus is on the initial sacrifice. We see throughout the book of Hebrews that connections to Abel are going to be to the martyrdom of Abel. And yet that still does not speak the same as the blood of Jesus. As we talk about a persecuted faith, however, I think this comes to the fore in Moses, those after Moses, and particularly as we get to the end of Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to try to cover all of that this afternoon, and then we'll just save chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, basically, for tomorrow to kind of see how this all applies. But having said that, John Lennox talks about the problem that Christians have is a problem of beauty and barbed wire. That when you look at this world, you see beauty as an evidence of God, but then you experience the barbed wire that is in this world. We might put it a slightly different way, that you do still have the fruit trees, but you also have the thorns. And this all goes back to a world that was created good, but now comes with a curse. And that in that curse, you have the seed of the devil who is still rising up against the seed of God, the seed of woman. And what we need to recognize is that Hebrews is speaking to the seed of woman, if you will, those who are in Christ, and that barbed wire is starting to tighten around them. And they need to see people in the Old Testament. And even after the Old Testament, history is related, in the time between the Testaments, and see that they are not alone in the persecuted faith, and that they are going to continue to bear the reproach of Jesus Christ, just as Moses did. And if they will do that, there is a reward waiting for them at the end. If I were to give two key words to this study, it's going to be boldness and bitterness. Boldness and bitterness. And they're often linked together. Because we're going to see some bold people who continued in faith and faithfulness to God, but their life was made bitter because they were faithful to Jesus. We're going to see how that plays out in just a moment, but I'd like us to sing a song about the bitterness, the barbed wire that we experience, but how that shows us the beauty of Christ and spurs us on to faithfulness to Him. Colton's going to lead us in that song. It's one of my new favorites, Jesus, Draw Me Ever Nearer. And following, what we find in the Mosaic period is that you start with the Exodus. That means your enemy is Egypt. You move on to the conquest, which means your enemy is Canaan. You move on to the judges, kings, and prophets. And maybe we could say the Philistines, or the Assyrians, or the Babylonians. Then you move into the time between the Testaments, and you get the Greeks. And then you get to the Christian age in chapter 12, and now it might just be the Romans, or maybe God's own special people, so-called before. The Christians are going to see themselves in a long line of persecuted saints, where the enemies of God, the worst of the worst, the greatest of the nations, have always come against the people of God. And the question is, what kind of faith do they have? Do they have a faith that is able to stand the persecution from the greatest powers of the earth? And yet the greatest powers of the earth are nothing in comparison to the God that they serve. These Christians need to see that. And they can look through the eyes of faith back to Moses, and they can see a man who bore the reproach of Jesus Christ. Look with me in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 23 through 28. Hebrews 11, verses 23 through 28. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that he was a beautiful child. and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Don't lose that whenever you pass by. I know by faith it's Moses' parents and not Moses himself. But what were they not afraid of? The king of the earth. The most powerful man in history at that moment. And they said, God's will is for this child to continue. And they kept him. Keep reading. It says, by faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure the ill treatment with the people of God than to endure the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. Let me just pause there, and I'm going to come back to this. But notice, Moses did something by faith as a protection of them. He connected himself with the people of God. Notice in verse, we'll get to 29 in just a moment. Focusing in on Moses for just a moment, I think what we could say as we look through all of these verses is that there's risk and reward. Risk and reward. Now, we've talked about, and I think it is a perfectly legitimate statement, various men have already said, that there's really no risk here. But if you look at skin, yeah, there's a little bit of risk. They're getting cut down. Their babies are getting thrown into the river. They're getting put into slavery. And they have to make a decision. Where does their faith ally them with? With whom does their faith ally them? Are they going to be faithful to God, the God of their fathers? Or are they going to become victimized by the king? You know, people of God can be victimized, but they don't have to fall into a victim mentality. Why? Because faith allows us to see him who is unseen. And Moses is the picture here. If we move away from his childhood to where he actually has a choice in this matter, notice, first of all, he chooses God and God's people. There's a significant point, I think, that is being made here with Moses choosing the people of God. Obviously, we all recognize this concept of you've got to choose God if you're going to be a person of faith. But notice the writer of Hebrews also connects this idea of if you are a person of faith, you choose God's people. Now, why is that significant? Let's just do a quick survey of Hebrews, just a couple of select passages. Look back at chapter 4 and verse number 2. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse number 2. Now, I know there's some translational issues here, but I just want us to note at least how I tend to think it is, and many translations seem to go along with this. As he's talking about the rest that was waiting for the people of God, he said, we have had good news preached to us, just as they also. Notice he's connecting these people in their persecuted wilderness with those people there in their sinful wilderness. But notice he says, they had gospel, we have gospel. That's the good news preached is the verb form of gospel. And so they were preached the gospel. We have been preached the gospel. But the word they heard did not profit them. Why? Because New American Standard says it was not united by faith in those who heard. I think the better reading is they did not unite with those who heard by faith. They did not unite with those who heard by faith. You see, what's the point here? If that alternate reading is correct, then what he's saying is the problem was not only that they didn't have faith, but they stepped away from those who did have faith. Doesn't that fit the story? That you've got people like Joshua and Caleb who are saying, we can do this. Say, we're not going to listen to those, we're not going to unite with those who had a faith that listened to God. And so their separation from not just personal faith, but even distancing themselves from those who did have faith, he says that's a problem for the people of God. That shows unbelief. That shows faithlessness when you distance yourself from the people of God. Look over in chapter 6 and verse 10. Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 10. As he comes to the present with these people, he says, "For God is not unjust so as to forget your work and the love which you have shown to his name." How do you show love to the name of God? How do you work for the name of God? In having ministered and in still ministering to the saints. And then you come to chapter 10, and he's really coming to the climax of his argument, at least his secondary argument. It's not just, you need to make sure you assemble with the saints. He's saying, you don't want to be what like the wilderness generation that distance themselves from people of faith. You want to be like you were at the beginning and seemingly still are, united with the saints. If things get difficult, you continue to be in allegiance with God's people. What might happen? Well, what might happen is that some of those people in your congregation might wind up in prison. Are you going to remember the prisoners? Are you going to unite with them? Even if that means you are going to be persecuted alongside them. He's saying this is not just about personal faith. This is about maintaining a connection to the people of God. And so Hebrews is not just saying you remain true to Jesus. It's saying you be in allegiance not only to Jesus, but also to everyone else who is in allegiance to Jesus. You maintain that connection. Moses is an example of someone who left the easier path, who left his allegiance to Egypt in order to show his allegiance to God. How? By showing allegiance to the people of God. He chose to suffer with God's people rather than to endure the passing pleasures of sin. We often go to this text just to show, yes, sin is pleasurable. That's a valid principle to get from this text. But notice the contrast here. He's saying the passing pleasures of sin are in contrast to suffering with God's people. He's trying to show this is not just about you. It's not just about me. It's about us. By faith, Moses allied himself with God and with the people of God. What did that look like? It looked like reproach. In chapter 10, this word is used. In chapter 10 of Hebrews, we read this Monday, but let's look again at verse 32. "But remember the former days when after being enlightened you endured the great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one." You know, sometimes if we just read Hebrews chapter 11 independently, we miss that he has specially selected Moses to say, you were acting just like Moses there back in the past. You were faithful to God. You were faithful to his people. Why? Because you saw something through faith that you could not see right now and you had not yet possessed. It says Moses did the same thing. If you hold Moses in high regard because he bore the reproach with the people of God, then don't stop doing what you did at the beginning. Keep bearing this reproach. Look in chapter 13 and verse 13. I don't think I brought this up previously, but one of the first times I studied Hebrews was with Brother L.A. Stopher. And I still remember that his overarching theme for the book of Hebrews is actually in chapter 13. This is a word of exhortation. So if you take nothing from what I've taught, at least take what L.A. taught, is that this is a word of exhortation. This is not an intellectual treatise on the nature of Jesus. This is saying, look to Jesus so that you're exhorted to be faithful to Jesus. This is a word of exhortation. And here at the very end, he, I think, brings the command, the expectation to its highest point in verse 13. "So let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach." You see how reproach is used all the way through. It's a, you bore the reproach of Christ. Moses bore the reproach of Christ. Now, let's do it now. When the rubber is meeting the road, will you continue to bear reproach? Or, we've talked a little bit about honor, shame, culture. I think Stephen maybe mentioned it, has mentioned it a little bit, maybe in past studies it's been talked about. But in essence, Roman culture is an honor, shame culture. And they view these Christians as shameful citizens who need to be shamed to come back in conformity with the rest of the Roman family. He says, you just don't be ashamed of Jesus. You bear the reproach. They're going to be trying to shame you into conformity. Does that sound familiar? They're going to try to shame you into conformity. You bear. You carry the reproach of Jesus Christ. Because His burden is light and His reward is far greater than what we're experiencing right now. Bear the reproach of Jesus Christ, just like Moses. What did that look like for Moses? I think Moses was in a situation that is unlike us, but also like us. He was one of the most powerful men in the world at that time. What did he do? Bearing reproach of Christ meant he gave up his position. It means he gave up pleasure. And he gave up possessions. Why? Because he was looking for a reward. From a worldly perspective, they'd say, you've got everything that you could possibly ever get. He says, that's nothing compared to what I want from the Lord. I want the reward of being faithful to Him. I'm willing to give up the position. I'm willing to give up the pleasures. I'm willing to give up the possessions because His reward is the only reward that really matters. It's an everlasting reward. It's an eternal inheritance. And Jesus made it possible. Now, that brings an interesting dynamic into this story of Moses. I don't know how much Moses knew, but at least what he suffered, the writer of Hebrews can say, that was the reproach of Christ. Is it a type of Jesus' own reproach? Is it similar to what the people of God would suffer? I think all those things are true. But I think we could say that Moses was ultimately looking to God and looking to Jesus and what he was willing to suffer, and so therefore he was bearing the reproach of Christ. And thus we could even say that not only was he bearing the reproach of Christ, but he was looking for the reward from Christ. I'm not saying he knew everything that we know, but I'm saying he knew enough to know to whom he needed to be allied. That brings us to another point I want us to consider about Moses, is that not only did he choose God and God's people, but he also chose faith over fear. He chose faith over fear. In verse number 27 of Hebrews 11, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 27, again it says, by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. Now, I don't see any purpose in getting into a big academic debate as to which Exodus this is talking about, whether it's his first Exodus or whether it's his second Exodus that is by himself over to Midian, or whether it's talking about along with the rest of God's people. But I tend to think that what it's saying here, in essence, is that, yes, Exodus says there was some fear, but he overcame his fear. Why? How? By faith. Would that speak to the people of that generation? Whom he has just said, look at Moses and see, you connect yourself with God, you connect yourself with God's people. Is there going to be anything scary about that? Absolutely. But you don't have to succumb to fear. You can, by faith, overcome this fear and do what God wants you to do. It is by knowing who God is, seeing He is a God who has made magnificent promises, and remaining faithful to Him, that fear becomes smaller and smaller in view of the great faith that we have through Him. Look with me in chapter 13, verses 5 and 6. Chapter 13, verses 5 and 6, as he is making exhortation based on what has come to this point, he says, "Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, 'I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you,' so that we may confidently say, 'The Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?'" Now again, this could just be the author of Hebrews wants them to be content, and it's a very generic statement, but I don't think so. I think all of the statements in Hebrews are set within the situation of persecution is coming, suffering is starting. And so what would this look like? Well, it might look like, are you willing to lose your job and be content with the little that you have here because you know God is on your side? Are we willing to say, I'm not going along with the agenda, and I may get a pay cut, I may lose my job, and I may have to work for half of what I was making before because I won't say they, them. Am I willing to do that to bear the reproach of Christ so that fear does not dictate my response, but faith dictates my response? Moses chose faith over fear, and God was able to train him and use him as the instigator of the Exodus. Finally, with Moses, we see that he chose God's plan, that faith means choosing God's plan and not ours. Faith means choosing God's plan and not ours. Notice the Passover is a picture of God's will in action with judgment. Did it require a response from the people of God? Did it require a response from Moses? Absolutely. And he had to do something that is almost like marching around the wall 7 times. Put some blood on your doorposts. A destroyer is coming. Moses had, as far as I know, hadn't seen the destroyer in person. He just knew God said, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to judge the gods of Egypt. I'm going to judge Pharaoh. I'm going to judge the people of Egypt. And if you don't want to be swept away in that judgment, you put the blood of a lamb on the doorposts. And you stay in your house. You wait for me and see the deliverance that I provide. You see, the Exodus came through faith. But the Exodus also came through the blood of a sacrifice. And Moses connected himself to that. And God saw him through to the other side so that they did come out of Egypt. The gods of Egypt were judged. And God was vindicated and magnified. Now, is that the end of the story? No, because what we find is that you need some faith from all the people when you get to the Red Sea as well. But God is going to prove Himself victorious when we finally get to the Red Sea. Why? Because God's people had trusted Him. They had kept the Passover, and the destroyer passed by, crossed over before them. So let's go on to Israel in verse number 29. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse number 29. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land. And the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. Now, when I look at Israel at the Red Sea, I don't necessarily think those are some people of faith. The writer of Hebrews says those are people of faith. Now, what's that look like? Well, that looks like a faith that is trusting Him who is not seen, that looks ahead based on a promise of God and waits for Him. Daniel Lockwood, he's a denominational fellow that did a book on Hebrews chapter 11. He said this about the faith of Israel at the Red Sea. "It was driven by necessity and confirmed by physical evidence, but it was faith just the same." And he goes on to say, it's because even though they complained, they eventually got to the point where they trusted God is going to do what Moses says God is going to do. And they waited. Now the people of God in New Testament times, at the time of Hebrews, they're hearing this word of exhortation saying, God's going to come through on His promise. Are you willing to wait at the Red Sea with the enemies at your back pushing you, prodding you, wondering what's going to happen, willing to wait all night until God opens the path and sees you through into the ultimate representation of the Exodus. You know, I don't think this is just a history lesson of interesting people who showed faith. He is selecting people that represent the very situation of the people of Hebrews. And he's saying, you've got to be like those Israelites. Stand still, see the salvation of the Lord. Wait. Wait on the Lord. He continues with Israel. Now, he doesn't mention Joshua as he moves into this conquest passage, but just look with me in Hebrews chapter 11, in verse number 30. He says, by faith, the walls fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. Now, whose faith is being discussed here? By faith, someone effected the falling of the walls. Well, I think we can imply from the Old Testament context that we've got Joshua here, we've got Israel here, that they stepped out in faith and they marched around the city and did exactly what God said to do. That's already been discussed eloquently by our brother Bob. But what I would note here is that you don't have Joshua mentioned. But Joshua is the name Jesus. And in chapter 4, if Joshua, moving forward a little bit in the story, if Joshua had provided them rest, then there wouldn't be a psalm talking about a further rest. Now, there's actually a minority opinion among some commentators who said, if Jesus had provided them rest, to say that He didn't provide them rest, He didn't perfect them, and so Jesus is actually doing that for us. I still think it's talking about Joshua. But the picture here is the conquest occurred by faith and was led by Captain Joshua, Jesus. And the people had to step behind him, keep their mouths shut until he said to shout, and walk around that city until God did what he said he was going to do. Stephen just got done teaching a survey of Revelation. And I think that is the picture of God's people being martyred. And they're praying to God, but they're keeping their mouths shut, waiting for King Jesus to lead them to victory so that when the gospel of this salvation is finally proclaimed in the judgment of the beast, then they shout. Then they celebrate. Jericho is just a picture of that. We are, in a sense, marching around Jericho. And from a worldly perspective, it seems like no one can get through these walls. No one's going to be able to subvert this culture. No one's going to be able to make any changes. God's people walk around the walls, and God can cause those walls to fall. How? By faith. Now, thus far, we're seeing a struggle, a suffering that occurs because people are choosing the will of God. Now we're seeing a victory, but it's still a warfare. It's still a fight. I think he's going to come back to this idea of persecution particularly, but just note here that he is saying there is escape for the people of God if they put their faith in God. There is victory for the people of God if they walk by faith. But then that brings us to the final inclusion in the by faith section. And it's not Israel, but it's someone who's going to come into Israel. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 31. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Now, I don't have time to kind of deal with the whole concept of she's called Rahab the harlot. So you've got a Gentile prostitute who now is accepted by faith, who is then brought into the people of God. But I do want us to focus on what he does say that sounds an awful lot like how he began this Mosaic section. By faith, Moses, bore reproach with the people, suffered with the people of God? How was Rahab delivered? She did not remain connected to the disobedient. She connected to the faithful Israel. You put this all together, and what he's saying is, yes, faith will be tested. Saints will suffer. But by faith, they will stay true to God and to His people until they march around that city and conquer Jericho. And you don't have to stay in Jericho anymore. You can be delivered by that scarlet rope that is hanging from the wall. The question is, will we have that kind of faith? The same kind of faith as Rahab, Israel, and Joshua. A new life is waiting for those who will be faithful. Now I want us to move into the final section here in verses 32 through 40. I've mentioned that this is, the author clues us in that he's kind of summing up everything he said, and he even switches from by faith to through faith. And so we have two through faiths in this section in verses 32 through 38, through 40. But notice what it says, what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Pause. That's where the verse should end. At least show a clear contrast that's about to occur. But notice, in this first part of the through faith section, he says, let me give you some representatives who had that same kind of Hebrews 11 verse 1 faith that we've been seeing all the way through. People who saw the invisible through faith, who hoped for what was promised by faith. Now some of these kind of surprise us. And we might say, well, how did Samson make the list? And I'll tell you the same thing that the author of Hebrews says, time would fail me to tell you. How through faith, these people conquered. I want us to keep the stream of the train of thought as we work our way through. He's just been talking about people who bore reproach and who won victory in these battles. Now he says, there is victorious faith for those whose faith is tested. You look at the judges, you look at the kings, you look at the prophets, you look at those Old Testament saints. What does he say is on the other side of their battle, of their fight? Victory. Now, I think we're going to see a contrast here that in the first half of this paragraph, God actually effected victory for them in their lifetime. Especially, look at the beginning of verse 35, women receive back their dead by resurrection. Now ultimately, we're all looking for resurrection, but he's saying they got it in this life. What appeared to be a defeat with the death of their children, he says, they receive back by resurrection. I'm going to be bringing up the death of children again. Because I think that's where he's going to focus is, are you willing to die? Is your household willing to die? Because you are a person who does all things through faith. You see, I think there's a reason he doesn't flip these to say, here are some people who suffered some bad things and didn't get a requital in this lifetime. He starts with the people who did get victory in this lifetime to say you are more than likely going to be the people on the other side of verse 35a. And so read with me. But others were tortured, not accepting their release so that they might obtain a better resurrection. Pause there for just a moment. Some women receive their dead back in this life. Some women saw their sons not accept release because they were looking for a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskin and goatskin, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, parentheses, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandered in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground, and all of these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Why? Because God has provided something better for us so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. Yes, some prevailed over the idolatry of their day, the enemies of their day, the oppression. Some even received a victory over death with their children being brought back to them. And some did not prevail in a physical sense. And God just said, I want you to persevere. You're going to prevail eventually. But all I want you to do right now is persevere. Because God has chosen not to give them a physical victory. Why would God do that? We're going to see in just a moment. I think I read a portion of this previously. You probably don't need to pull out your Bible because it's not in the Bible. It's just in a Catholic Bible. But in the time between the Testaments, the writer of Hebrews is not validating the Apocrypha as inspired by God, but he is alluding to those faithful people at that time. And if you see any parallels, you've got an oppressive government and a king who's coming in and saying that you cannot be faithful to your God and you need to prove that you're not faithful to your God and that you're not allied with his people anymore by eating pork and serving the false gods. And I want to read to you two stories, and I know it'll take a few minutes. I want to tell you about an old man, a Jew by the name of Eliezer. And I want to tell you about an older woman and her seven sons. This is from 2 Maccabees, chapter 6. I would just note that in chapter 5, he's already talked about that there was a massacre of young and old, destruction of boys, women, and children, and slaughter of young girls and infants. Within the total of three days, 80,000 were destroyed. This is by the Greeks. 40,000 in hand-to-hand fighting, and as many were sold into slavery and were killed. But then you come with that backdrop of the Greeks coming in and saying, people of God, don't be faithful to God. Here's what happens if you are faithful. Then you have a man by the name of Eliezer. Eliezer, one of the scribes in high position, a man now advanced in age and of noble presence, was being forced to open his mouth to eat swine's flesh. But he, welcoming death with honor rather than life with pollution, went up to the rack of his own accord, spitting out the flesh, as all ought to go, who have the courage to refuse things that it is not right to taste, even for the natural love of life. Those who were in charge of that unlawful sacrifice took the man aside because of their long acquaintance with him and privately urged him to bring meat of his own providing, proper for him to use, and to pretend that he was eating the flesh of the sacrificial meal that had been commanded by the king, so that by doing this, he might be saved from death and be treated kindly on account of his old friendship with them. Let me just pause. You've got the oppressors who are coming in and saying, eat the flesh of a swine that's been offered to Zeus. And he says, no. And then his fellow Jews come along and say, you don't really have to eat the flesh of a swine. You pick your own meat and just say, this is the flesh of a swine. You don't really have to believe that he is a she and she is a he, but just use the pronouns that they are saying to use. But making a high resolve worthy of his years and the dignity of his old age and the gray hairs that he had reached with distinction in his excellent life, even from childhood, and moreover, according to the holy God-given law, he declared himself quickly, telling them to send him to Hades. Quote, he says, such pretense is not worthy of our time of life, he said. For many of the young might suppose that Eliezer, in his 90th year, has gone over by an alien religion to an alien religion. And through my pretense, for the sake of living a brief moment longer, they would be led astray because of me. Saying, I'm thinking about the generation behind me as well. And he says, all this while I defile and disgrace my old age. Even if for the present I would avoid the punishment of mortals, yet whether I live or die, I will not escape the hands of the Almighty. Therefore, by bravely giving up my life now, I will show myself worthy of my old age and leave to the young a noble example of how to die a good death willingly and nobly for the revered and holy laws. When he had said this, he went at once to the rack. Those who a little before had acted toward him with goodwill now changed to ill will, because the words he had uttered were, in their opinion, sheer madness. When he was about to die under the blows, he groaned aloud and said, it is clear to the Lord in his holy knowledge that though I might have been saved from death, I am enduring terrible sufferings in my body under this beating. But in my soul, I am glad to suffer these things because I fear him. So in this way he died, leaving in his death an example of nobility and a memorial of courage, not only to the young, but to the great body of his nation. There were some who were unwilling to compromise. The widow. It happened also that seven brothers and their mother were arrested and were being compelled by the king under torture with whips and thongs to partake of unlawful swine's flesh. One of them, acting as their spokesman, said, what do you intend to ask and learn from us? For we are ready to die rather than transgress the laws of our ancestors. The king fell into a rage and gave orders to have pans and cauldrons heated. They were heated immediately, and he commanded that the tongue of their spokesman be cut out, and that they scalp him and cut off his hands and feet, while the rest of his brothers and the mother looked on. When he was utterly helpless, the king ordered them to take him to the fire, still breathing, and to fry him in a pan. The smoke from the pan spread widely, but the brothers and their mother encouraged one another to die nobly, saying, the Lord God is watching over us and in truth has compassion on us, as Moses declared in his song that bore witness against the people to their faces when he said, and he will have compassion on his servants. After the first brother had died in this way, they brought forward the second for their sport. They tore off his skin of his head with the hair and asked him, will you eat rather than have your body punished limb from limb? He replied in the language of his ancestors and said, no. Therefore, he in turn underwent tortures as the first brother had done. And when he was at his last breath, he said, you accursed wretch, you dismiss us from the present life, but the King of the universe will raise us up to an everlasting renewal of life because we have died for his laws. Maybe it sounds like some people who accepted death for a better resurrection. After him, the third was the victim of their sport. When he was demanded, he quickly put out his tongue and courageously stretched out his hands and said nobly, I got these from heaven, and because of his laws, I disdain them, and from him I hope to get them back again. As a result, the king himself and those with him were astonished at the young man's spirit, for he regarded his sufferings as nothing. After he too had died, they maltreated and tortured the fourth in the same way. When he was near death, he said, one cannot but choose to die at the hands of mortals and to cherish the hope God gives of being raised again by him. But for you, there will be no resurrection to life. Next, they brought forward the fifth and maltreated him. But he looked at the king and said, because you have authority among mortals, though you also are a mortal, you do what you please. But do not think that God has forsaken our people. Keep on and see how his mighty power will torture you and your descendants. After him, they brought forth the sixth. And when he was about to die, he said, do not deceive yourself in vain, For we are suffering these things on our own account because of our sins against our own God. Therefore, astounding things have happened, but do not think that you will go unpunished for having tried to fight against God. Speaking of a father who put the wood on his son, the mother was especially admirable and worthy of honorable memory. Although she saw her seven sons perish within a single day, she bore it with good courage because of her hope in the Lord. She encouraged each of them in the language of their ancestors. Filled with a noble spirit, she reinforced her woman's reasoning with a man's courage and said to them, "I do not know how you came into being in my womb. It was not I who gave you life or breath, nor I who set in order your life and set in order the elements within each of you. Therefore, the Creator of the world, who shaped the beginning of humankind and devised the origin of all things, will in His mercy give life and breath back to you again, since you now forget yourselves for the sake of His laws." Antiochus felt that he was being treated with contempt, and he was suspicious of her reproachful tone. The youngest brother being still alive, Antiochus not only appealed to him in words, but promised with oaths that he would make him rich and enviable if he would turn from the ways of his ancestors, and that he would take him for his friend and entrust him with public affairs. Since the young man would not listen to him at all, the king called the mother to him and urged her to advise the youth to save himself. After much urging on his part, she undertook to persuade her son. But leaning close to him, she spoke in their native language as follows, deriding the cruel tyrant, "My son, have pity on me. I carried you 9 months in my womb and nursed you for 3 years and have reared you and brought you up to this point in your life and have taken care of you. I beg you, my child, to look at the heaven and the earth and see everything that is in them and recognize that God did not make them out of things that existed. And in the same way the human race came into being, do not fear this butcher, but prove worthy of your brothers. Accept death, so that in God's mercy I may get you back again along with your brothers." While she was still speaking, the young man said, "What are you waiting for? I will not obey the king's command, but I obey the command of the law that was given through our ancestors, to our ancestors through Moses. But you who have contrived all sorts of evil against the Hebrews will certainly not escape the hands of God, for we are suffering because of our own sins. And if our living Lord is angry for a little while to rebuke and discipline us, he will again be reconciled to his own servants. But you, unholy wretch, you most defiled of all mortals, do not be elated in vain and puffed up by uncertain hopes when you raise your hand against the children of heaven. You have not yet escaped the judgment of the Almighty, all-seeing God. For our brothers, after enduring a brief suffering, have drunk of ever-flowing life under God's covenant. But you, by the judgment of God, will receive your punishment, just punishment, for your arrogance. I, like my brothers, give up body and life for the laws of our ancestors, appealing to God to show mercy soon to our nation, and by trials and plagues to make you confess that He alone is God, and through me and my brothers to bring to an end the wrath of the Almighty that has justly fallen on our nation." The king fell into a rage and handled him worse than the others, being exasperated at his scorn, so he died in his integrity, putting his whole trust in the Lord. Last of all, the mother died after her sons. Let this be enough then about eating of sacrifices and extreme tortures. When the writer of Hebrews said, some sons did not accept release, and the mothers did not receive them, it's because they were willing to suffer for the cause of Christ, even before Christ was here. They bore the reproach. They suffered for the law. And I have no doubt, if this is all true, that mother will receive her sons back by resurrection someday. See, the question is, when the writer of Hebrews brings up these examples, he's asking, are we willing to walk by that kind of faith? A perseverant, persistent faith that remains true to the Lord. Because you know what he says about all these people, verses 39 and 40? They haven't received what they hope for, and they won't apart from us. We're going to walk through the finish line together, and we're going to receive the crown of victory with all the faithful who have gone before, who have suffered and been victorious. The crown of righteousness is coming. Faith in the patriarchal age was a faith that bore reproach, that waited on the Lord, that prevailed in struggle, but persevered in death. Will we have that kind of a faith? We'll close out Hebrews chapter 11 with chapter 12 tomorrow.